Support for The Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars to West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on The Front Porch. This week we're talking about the challenges in getting low-income West Virginians ready for work with a man who's been on the front lines of that fight for 20 years. Pastor Matthew J. Watts leads the Grace Bible Church in Charleston. He's the founder of Hope Community Development Corporation. Pastor Watts, thanks for coming on The Front Porch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we're here as always with Rick Wilson, hillbilly philosopher.
Hey, Scott. Good to be here.
And also Lori Landon, lawyer and conservative columnist who tweets at WV Pundit. Hey, Lori.
Hi, guys.
All right, well, Reverend Watts, why don't we just start with the big picture. You help especially young people every single day get ready for employment, find employment. What are the challenges that these young people are facing in order to become employable and get jobs and keep jobs?
I think one of the real problems, Scott, is that young people today have become so removed from the world of work. So we're graduating kids through high school who don't have a marketable skill, who don't have the basic skill to do college level work, and they don't have the discipline of work. Because in many cases, they come from families where there have not been people that have gotten up and went to work every single day.
Reverend Watts, can we talk a little bit about your background then? Because this is a really good chance to talk about how you grew up. You grew up in Mount Hope, which is
That's
a mining
correct.
Town in Fayette County.
That is correct.
Talk about how you go from there to here. You've come a long way. You were an engineer at Union Carbide, a purchasing manager, and now, you know, running this successful community development corporation, a leader in the community. What was it about your upbringing in Mount Hope that prepared you for that?
That's an excellent question. A very small rural coal mining town, and my family was an anomaly at that time because most families, black and white, were two-parent household families, but we were a single female household, and I'm the fourth of seven children. My grandmother helped my mother raise us, but I was always connected to the world of work. I've had my name on some type of account at a bank since I was 7 years old. My grandmother ordered seeds from wherever they get these seeds from. She'd have me knocking on doors selling flower seeds, vegetable seeds, et cetera. She would take me to the country to an orchard where I would pick berries and then bring them back and knock on the door and sell those berries. When I was about 9 years old, she got my first paper route with grit newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I would go door to door trying to sell the grit. You know, for 15 cents, I got to keep a nickel. And so I was raised to realize that I had to work. And so I had paper routes until I graduated from high school. I worked the Job Training Partnership Act or the CETA program. At 14 years of age, I had summer jobs where I went to carry newspapers early in the morning and then went to work cleaning out streams or painting posts along the side of the road. So work was a part of what it meant to be a human being, right? We didn't get allowances, right, for my mother or my grandmother. We were expected to earn. And education, we believe, to be the great equalizer. So being poor, single female household, on commodities before food stamps, we never thought that any way could keep us from doing what we wanted to do. Because my mother and my grandmother basically said that this world belongs to people who have literacy and numeracy skills. And if you get an education inside your head, no one can take that away from you. And the only way you deal with the racism and stuff that we dealt with growing up. So we really believe that, you know, that if we got educated, that we could compete. And we didn't think no one could stop us from doing that. And that we'd work as hard as we needed to work to demonstrate our value and our worth. So I was raised quite differently than the way children are raised today on the west side of Charleston.
What do you think has happened since then? What has changed such that kids now don't see that value of work?
We've had an historic degeneration of the two-parent family household in poor communities, particularly in the African-American community. The west side of Charleston, where I live and where I work, in 1960, 77% of all black children were born in a two-parent household. 77% were born in a two-parent household. Today on the west side of Charleston, only 14% of the children live in a two-parent household. And so there's this breakdown of the family. But this breakdown of the family, it's not merely a social breakdown. The economy has a lot to do with how the family configures itself, right? And so if you look in the upper middle class people, they're marrying at about the same rates that they've always married. It is the lower income people that are marrying at much lower rates because, you know, fathers can't provide for their children, et cetera.
So do you ever have a conversation with young people about, so why don't you get married? And what do you hear back from people?
Almost every day. I mean, almost every day, because I've done more funerals over the last 30 years than I've done weddings for young people on the west side of Charleston. And it's just gut-wrenching. What has happened is that we have lost the value of the institution of marriage. So we've got to make a case for marriage again, right? Young people do not see marriage as this institution that stabilizes communities, that stabilizes the society, as many of us believed it to do. So you start making the case where marriage makes a social difference in the society. The stability of the society is more stable where marriages are high.
And is the other part of that, then we have to have marriageable young people, especially marriageable men.
That's correct.
And marriageable, what does that mean in the eyes of a young woman? What would be someone that would be like, this guy is someone I'd like to marry, that it's a good bet that it's going to be a stable relationship?
Stable employment. He has a job. He is employed, preferably a job with benefits, right? It means that we can have private health insurance and that we might have the opportunity to purchase a home. That's what young women are still looking for. They're looking for someone that's going to be a partner, and they're certainly not afraid of work, but they're looking for someone that can that's going to be employable, that's going to be employed, that's going to help to be the breadwinner, and that's going to provide them some stability for their family. A lot of young men don't propose marriage because they know that they cannot provide the stability. A lot of the young women accept something less than marriage because they know that that person can't provide the stability that they're looking for. But I think what I find in most of the instances, the young women still yearn to be married. And it's a great source of great pain and great hurt within the African-American community. The number of single female-headed households and young women who know they probably will never marry.
There's a natural course for people's life. You know, you go to school, you get out of school, you work, you find somebody, you get in a more or less long-term thing. And that incarceration, especially early in life, disrupts that whole flow of the life course. And it really shows it affects not just employment, but earnings, relations with kids, likelihood of being able to marry, future educational attainment.
West Virginia's prison population has quadrupled since 1970.
You know what's shocking is our population is exactly the same.
See, that is the point. And that's the point I'm getting ready to make. We have over-incarceration because of over-prosecution.
And crime rate's stable too, pretty much.
That's the point I'm getting ready to make. Crime rate has not increased as much as people think. Our crime rate has a net increase of 14% over the last 40 years. But our incarceration rate increases despite what the crime rate does during that period of time. And let me tell you why. Because the over-incarceration in West Virginia, over-prosecutes, has nothing to do really with crime. What it has to do is that between 1978 and 2015, we lost over 55% of our manufacturing jobs. Over 55%. We went from 125,000 to less than 60,000, right? So we lost the manufacturing jobs. The other thing that happened during that period of time, starting with the in the early 70s, right, when the Vietnam War, the draft was ended in 72. The Vietnam War ended in 75. And so now you see the drop in the size of the United States military from 3.5 million people in 1968 at the peak of the Vietnam conflict to 1.5 million people today. What I'm submitting to you is that the prison system basically is being used to manage the surplus of undereducated, underskilled labor that results from technological advances, mechanization, change of the economy from manufacturing base to information base, and globalization. West Virginia is the perfect example of that. There's no other explanation as to why our prison population would grow so rapidly. So the prison population basically is absorbing some of the surplus labor through the management, constructions, and maintenance of prisons. So many of the people that work in the prison system today, they'd be working in manufacturing jobs 25, 30 years ago, but those jobs are not there. They're working in prisons today.
So, Pastor Watts, you talk about over-prosecution. What specifically type of offenses should we not be prosecuting?
I think that we should prosecute, you know, anything that violates the law. The discretion comes in at the sentencing phase. And I do think that we've over-prosecuted nationally in terms of how quickly we have given people felonies for low-level, in some cases, low-level drug trafficking, which I don't think should get a felony charge.
So more probation, more other interventions, not jail time.
In my opinion, working with juveniles and with adult offenders is that prison should be reserved for the people that are so disruptive to the society, violent people, murderers, rapists, people who just won't live under the rule of law. We should reserve the prisons for those individuals. And we've got a lot of people that are incarcerated that basically they become unemployable. We're artificially depleting the size of the workforce. Every time we give someone a felony conviction, basically, we are marginalizing their employability. We are regulating to a permanent underclass and undercast. We're making it difficult for them to provide for their children. So we're basically assigning to ourselves the responsibility to take care of their children. There are 150,000 convicted felons in the state of West Virginia. 150,000, that is over 10% of the adult population.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, more with Pastor Matthew Watts on getting education and employment for our youth. But first, you're listening to The Front Porch right now because more than 10,000 people are proud members of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. What's a member? It's anyone who's made a donation to West Virginia Public Broadcasting in the last 12 months. Are you a member yet? If not, it's easy to join. Just go to wvpublic.org and click the red donate button.
Pastor Watts, you know I love the Bible, but I love Nietzsche too. I believe you got to cover all the bases. He had something, you know, when you lock up people who are not really a threat to public safety, they can become one, you know.
Absolutely.
And Nietzsche had this to say, and it's a quote that I think about a lot. Generally speaking, punishment makes men hard and cold. It concentrates, it sharpens the feeling of alienation, it strengthens the power of resistance.
Well, let me just put this to both of you, maybe Rick first. Do you believe in a deterrent effect of punishment? You know, the example, this, if you do this bad thing, this will happen to you. Do you believe that there's a value to that? Of course, it doesn't have to be prison. It could be other things.
I think it works in some circumstances and not in others. Like probably driving, it probably works really well for, you know, crimes of passion, not so much. And, you know, if
people who are addicted.
Yeah,
not
what
so
about
much.
Drugs?
And if you're living, if you experience all kind of informal sanctions, you know, then maybe not so much too. All those things would tend to diminish it. So it might work in some situations better than in others.
What about retribution? What about the idea that you have done something to society and society need, you know, eye for an eye?
Eye for an eye was originally intended to limit vengeance. I mean, it means that, okay, you stepped on my Nikes, therefore I will kill you is impermissible in biblical terms and things like that. So it actually in the Torah is an argument for measured responses.
So you're saying if we take a low-level drug dealer and we give them a felony, which is a life sentence in a way.
Social death, it's been called.
So that's... That is not an eye for an eye. That's death for an eye.
So what's appropriate? Then?
But just
what's
think it. Let's think it through. You put this person in a place where they're surrounded by other violent people, where you almost have to be violent or manipulative or to carry on the threat of violence to survive. Where you call, I'm just going to use some language here, okay? Where you call someone who is weaker than you that you could take advantage of, a bitch. You know, and you know how you think of all these things and play it out, and then boom, okay, you're out. How do you think that's going to work?
Yeah,
there are better
are
ways
to
treat people.
What are we going to do with
people?
All these people who are on the state payroll if we reduce the prison population?
Well, I love the conservative making this argument.
you're right. The greatest thing, look, if you look at the history of the United States of America, right, you'll find one of the greatest expansion in the size of the government in the history of this country has happened since 1971. With Nixon's declaration of the war on drugs in 71, Reagan's in the 80s, and Clinton-Biden crime bill of 94. It's been the greatest expansion in the federal and the state government, maybe in the history of the country.
I watched in the 90s, and I was a reporter in the 90s, when they started to pass some of these mandatory sentencing laws at the state level. Every judge and every lawmaker is scared to death that if they are lenient in a sentence, this one person that you let off today, tomorrow goes out and murders somebody, and it'll be used in a campaign commercial against you. So how do you deal with those sorts of situations, Pastor Watt?
I think the real challenge is we've got to have a robust discussion and conversation in terms of how we got here. And most people really don't understand how we got here. How we got here is actually anchored in the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And most people don't realize that.
Explain that, because I don't know.
Well, the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution basically eliminated the private practice of slavery, whereby a private citizen could not hold another private citizen. So the text of the 13th Amendment, and this is a very close quote, it says that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude should be allowed in the United States or into the territories under the jurisdiction of the United States, except for the punishment of a crime whereby the person was unduly convicted. So in the text of the 13th Amendment, 43 words, 13 of the words lay out as to how the government now can continue to practice slavery. Why would you have put the most inflammatory word in the United States of America at the time in the text of the 13th Amendment, which was supposed to eliminate slavery? The reason it's put there is it was a safety valve, that just in case these freed slaves became unruly, just in case they were pillaging and destroying the land, we used the criminal justice system to bring them back into servitude. And that's exactly what happened. After the Reconstruction ended in the early 1870s, the South then went on a campaign to reinstitute slavery. It was called slavery by another name, convict leasing, where the criminal justice system was used to bring predominantly black men and a lesser number of poor white men into prison for something as minor as vagrancy. And then their sentence could be sold to a private company. The way the United States government has always controlled black people has been through whether or not they had citizenship or not, or whether or not they had the full expression of their citizenship. And so then the Civil Rights Movement brings the hope of full citizenship, right? 64 Civil Rights Act, 65 Voters' Rights Act. We're going to move towards a society where everybody has equal citizenship. But then what happens in the 70s and 80s, the war on drugs is introduced. And what does the war on drugs do in effect? It revokes parts of a person's citizenship, limits parts of their citizenship, and restricts parts of their citizenship for the rest of their life. And they never can regain what they've lost. Even if it was for a minor, nonviolent drug offense, even if it was for writing bad checks of $1,000, they get a felony conviction. The most important thing it means is that for the rest of their life, they can be legally discriminated against for employment, for housing, and for any other reason. A person that's a felon do not have equal protection of the law of the 14th Amendment. And that's what the real problem is. And so they're locked into this. And according to the Justice Department, there are 40 to 70 million people in this country that are felons.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the bill that was in the legislature that dealt with this idea that you would be able to expunge your felony conviction. Am I getting that right, Rick?
You could petition the court after 5 years to have a felony conviction expunged from your record, but other people had to sign off on it. It wasn't an easy thing. It was just a real minor, modest step.
It wasn't even, there's this whole nationwide movement about ban the box. In other words, let's stop people from asking about it in employment. This is much more modest. This is saying if I've, you know, I'm been out of jail, I've succeeded in keeping clean, I can petition to get this felony taken off my record after 5 years.
It sailed through the Senate with bipartisan support, including some of the most conservative.
And then it went to the House and just never went anywhere. It died in committee, right, Rick?
Right. There was a motion to discharge it to the floor for a vote, and that didn't pass either, although I think had it come up for an open vote, it probably would have passed.
I think that this bill was a good step in the right direction, but I don't think that this bill would have had any real impact at all. This is the information age. All I need to do is Google your name. And so I can find out a lot about you, and I certainly can find out about whether or not you've been in the court system or not.
So how do we deal with the larger issue of I have a felony now. Everyone can know it for the rest of my life. How do we tell employers to give someone a second look, a second chance?
Well, see, you got to have the conversation, number one, to help employers understand is that for the most part, these are decisions that employers are making. No one has put a gun to their head and telling them you can't hire someone with a record. We've created this culture that a person that has a felony is a bad person. They're unredeemable. They're unreliable. They're going to steal everything that you have. You don't want to hire any of these people that have felons. See? And so we've created that as an imagery.
Like the word felon, Lori, what does that word conjure up in your head, felon?
Oh, you know, a guy in a jumpsuit, you know, a prisoner, a scary bad guy, certainly. You have to look at it from the employer's perspective, especially given, you know, we have very high unemployment here, which means that when I, as an employer, am looking for someone to hire, I have a whole lot of people applying. In some cases, especially for big employers where the hiring process is just really kind of automated and not real personal, you know, do you have a felony? It's just a way of kind of an easy way of weeding people out. So you say, do you have a felony? Okay, you know, 20%, that eliminates 20% of the people. You still have a ton of great applicants. What's your incentive?
You know, it's funny.
As an employer,
you don't have a ton of great applicants in West Virginia. Most employers will tell you that I'm having difficulty identifying, you know, an applicant pool. 6% of all manufacturing jobs in West Virginia goes unfilled because they can't find applicants.
Which makes you want to tear out your hair.
Yes.
Right. And then you have the drug test issue, you know, that employers say, well, people can't pass drug tests even if they don't have a record.
So what we're saying, Scott, that if you were caught doing something that a lot of other people also did, but because you got caught doing it, you got arrested and you got prosecuted and convicted, it means that you're just worse than all those other people that ever did that. There are a lot of people that have committed felony crimes. They just didn't get caught.
Pastor Matthew Watts leads the Grace Bible Baptist Church in Charleston, founder of the Hope Community Development Corporation. Pastor Watts, thanks for coming on the Front
Porch.
Thanks
for having me.
And that's the Front Porch for this week. As always, you've been joined by Rick Wilson, the American Friends Service Committee, and Lori Lynn, a conservative columnist and lawyer. Hey, one more thing. Did you know you can listen to all your favorite West Virginia public broadcasting shows on demand? More and more people are discovering the podcast for Mountain Stage, Inside Appalachia, and even The Front Porch. Download our podcast on your smartphone on our new West Virginia Public Broadcasting app, and you can listen on your own time. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening.